Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 50, recorded April 27th, 2012. Zay Frank. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker who needs stock video clips, photos, illustrations, music tracks, or sound effects, check out Pond5 for instant downloads at the best prices anywhere. Check out Pond5 at pond5.com. And for 25% off this month, use code TWIT25. Welcome to Triangulation, episode 50. I'm Tom Merritt, Leo Laporte off in Norway. So filling in today on the show, Sarah Lang. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. It's really good to be here.
How's it feel to be one of the sides of the triangle?
Well, it's great because I like our triangle today. It's why I decided to accept your offer to be one of the sides of what is the strongest geometrical shape.
Well, when I first asked you if you wanted to do triangulation, you very quickly said no.
I said Friday morning, that's not really my thing.
But when I said, you know what, we're going to be joined by Zay Frank as the base of our triangle.
Absolutely.
I'm the base.
Welcome to base.
Yeah, what's up?
Not much. Thanks for joining us, man. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah, my pleasure.
So, Zay Frank, most people probably know from the internet.
That's how I know him.
Yeah. When did you first use the internet?
When did I first use the internet? I guess, I think I used it a little bit in college. Was it? Yeah, I was around then. Yeah. I don't think I had an email account in college. I probably first got an email account in like 1997.
Well, you graduated from Brown in 95, right?
That's right.
So, yeah, there would have been internet, just it's not the internet that we know of today.
That's right. It was all just black and white at that point. But I know that, I mean, I think that I used it a little bit for something, but not definitely not research. I mean, I don't recall ever using anything as fancy as what we have now. Back then, books, stacks, things like that. Mm-hmm. How about you? When was the first time you used the internet?
First time I used the internet was also in college, in a journalism class.
Mm-hmm.
And I used Gopher to research stories.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I used, you know, I studied neuroscience. And so, like, I used, there was an environment, the Sun Meadows environment, that I learned how to code in. But again, I don't think that was really networked. It was just all these sort of, like, standalone things.
What about you?
First time I ever used the internet, I'm not sure when the first time is that I ever logged on, because we had a modem that we used to get games off of BBSs at home earlier than I really understood what we were doing.
But oh, snack.
Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. No. So you're totally bringing back some memories now.
Yeah.
Because, like, the first time that I used the internet was with Matt, and I'm forgetting his last name, but now we're talking about, like, eighth or ninth grade. We would go online on, I don't even know what they were, some back channel somewhere and download games and things like that. Back when, you know, you would save your games on a tape recorder.
Oh, yeah. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I definitely was at Donald Hertz's house downloading Commodore 64 games from a BBS.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. God, those games. That was something. You really had to use your imagination for that, you know?
It was good, though. Now, a lot of people in the audience know you from the show, but a lot of people who may be trying to place you may recognize you from the first big internet thing you were involved in that was widely popular, which was the dancing.
It was a birthday invitation, wasn't it? And you just wanted a creative way to let people know that it was going to be a really fun party.
It was a birthday invitation. I had basically after college, I joined a rock band, and then I was very broke, and the band broke up, and so I joined an advertising company. And in that time, I started to learn a little bit about design, and I had a little bit of a coding background. And so I was sort of fascinated by the ways that you could get moving images onto web pages, because at that point there weren't, really wasn't any video. I mean, there's like real players and things like that, and embeddable QuickTime.
2001 or 2004?
No, this is like 98, 99.
Oh, no,
and
okay. Really
and so like, you know, Flash 2 and super plot,
those
whatever
little postage stamp reel videos.
Exactly, yeah. And so I started, playing around with basically using animated GIF-style stuff within Flash to simulate movies. And then, yeah, I posted a little thing called How to Dance Properly for a birthday invitation and sent it to just a few of my friends. But there it is. Yeah. Yeah, and then that went viral. Yeah. The Hog Pit was getting calls from, you know, all over the country. Wanting to know whether the party was actually taking place, but it got moved.
did you end up having a lot of unexpected guests?
No, I mean it was moved. It, you know, there was no way that I was going to like take that risk.
But they didn't find you, is what I'm.
I was recognized the first night afterwards, which was weird. I don't think you can really get much from that. I don't really look like that anymore, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, my dad found out about that link from a colleague of his in Venezuela before I had a chance to tell him.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, that was it was still, I mean, memes are still cool many times, but that was when they were fresh. And I remember that being passed around at Tech TV around the offices and people like, you know, looking at it. And then years later, when you started doing the show, I didn't connect the two at first. What fill in the gaps for me there from unintended internet stardom to.
Yeah, it was like a good 5-year period.
Greeting the sports racers.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly wasn't internet stardom, right? I mean, it was Jackass dancing on a screen.
That's internet stardom. Those are yeah, pretty much the same thing. Mahir, et cetera.
Well, you got a Webby Award for the best
true,
personal
right.
website. So,
so basically what happened was, and I talk about this, there's a talk online where I sort of like, you know, talk about this a little bit more in detail. You know, basically, I had this like massive amount of traffic coming through, and I was completely obsessed with that phenomenon. There wasn't all that much out there on any personal experiences of you know, viral traffic. So it was super new and fresh, and I didn't really have people to talk to about it. But I was definitely interested in trying to figure out what the dynamics of that was. You know, like why did this thing become popular, and so I just started creating tons and tons and tons of content, and that was basically the first like 2 years of ZayFrank.com. Was I was just like trying to make other things that might be viral, and I had no idea really what I was doing, so I copied myself. I made, you know, I mean, the lowest point I was How to Dance Properly 2.
A logical move. I mean,
oh, yeah. Totally. Like, I kept everything the same. Like, I just did more of the same crap, you know?
Right.
Like,
if you like How to Dance Properly, you'll love.
Exactly.
How to,
yeah. Exactly.
It's worked for Hollywood quite well.
Right.
It does.
Right. And then, you know, as it became clear that, you know, there was sort of, I had to look a little bit farther and deeper. I just started making a lot of different kinds of content. I taught myself more about, you know, coding online. And I started, I was interested, like, you know, when video, like it was possible to embed QuickTime movies, I was like, oh, I'd really like to start trying to make some videos. I didn't really know what I was doing. So there was a buddy of mine, and he was interested in doing videos as well. So we were like, what's the best way to learn? And we were like, let's start a film festival. So we started a film festival called Day 60, where every 60 days you had to create a film. And we screened it at a bar somewhere. And it was ostensibly for first-time filmmakers. And so that's sort of like, you know, how I started making videos was back then.
It's kind of like NaNoWriMo for videos, except over two months instead of National Novel Writing Month. But the same idea, which is you give yourself a deadline and force yourself to be creative.
Yeah, it was neat too. I mean, you know, the words, like the every 2 months it was a theme. And by the way, like everybody made their film in the last 2 days.
Of course.
I mean,
the two month
period was like arbitrary. I mean, but
you have two months to procrastinate.
2 months exactly. To the 48-hour movie fest.
Right.
But and every time we got together, we would choose a new theme. By it was something like the 30th word on the 5th page of like the Daily Post.
Spy messages.
Yeah, it was like Inside was one of the themes, which is, you know, out there. Red Alert was another one. So it was pretty interesting. So, yeah, that's what got me started with videos. And I did a whole bunch of earlier, videos while I was kind of just making all sorts of different content. And you know, just that was where I also started playing around with participation, little sort of like contests and things like that. Like when Office Supplies Attack, which was like one of my favorites.
It's one of my favorites too. What led you to want to get people involved? You know, some people might say, no, I'm the auteur. I'm going to make the videos and I want to see how they react. What was the instinct that said, hey, I want to get people involved in doing this with me?
Well, I think, I mean, it certainly wasn't just a novel idea. I think that there was a lot of, you know, this sort of transition period where, you know, there was that first period of the web in the kind of like late 90s and early 2000s, which it was just this like discovery place, you know, like this weird crap, and you would find it and you would share all the links. And it was very, very sort of like you said, top down content driven. And then there was the switch in the web 2.0 thing. And there was a lot of like really nice, examples of people starting to come together to do stuff. And I also had just a very fundamental problem, which was that I was kind of running out of ideas. And I was, at that point, I was trying to make a project every day. And, it was a ton of work. So I just started asking people to submit things. And I was really bad at it. there's so many, you know, I've been now doing this for quite a while, trying to collaborate with audiences and find interesting ways to come together. But man, there's a learning curve, you know, because there's so many traps. I think the biggest trap that I fell into in the beginning was like the volume trap, where you're like, you know, what would be cool is if like people submitted images of themselves holding up like a CD. And then if there's like 20,000 of those, like they could all be pixels, you know, on a
right.
You know, and you're just, that's like, that's such terrible thinking. You know, the idea that just like so much of something is going to make it good.
Or it's a great idea if you have a big team working with you.
Or a good algorithm.
To
display those CDs in a nice visual way. So you mentioned that you were running out of ideas. At the same time, you've launched a daily, at least a weekday, 5 day a week show. And you want participation from your viewers and your audience. I mean, here at TWiT, Tom and I do a daily show, and a lot of our audience feedback we try to put as much of it into the show as possible, and that's time consuming. It's great to drive content and to drive the conversation, but it's a whole another several hours a day wading through all of that stuff. How did you deal with that? Was it really a one man show as it seemed back in 2006, or did you have people helping you?
Yeah, no, it was a one man show in the sense that I, you know, I didn't really write scripts. I improvised them to camera one line at a time, and I edited and uploaded and everything like that. There were, obviously collaborators in the sense that the audience was a collaborator, and there was a guy that helped out with some of the big coding challenges that were way beyond me. For example, there was a really gorgeous Google Maps hack that powered the Earth sandwich. And, you know, so I did get some help on the sort of like technology side of the day-to-day operation of, you know, running the technology that was behind behind the show. But, yeah, sifting through stuff, you know, I don't know. The premise of the show, you know, the beginnings of it really were, I mean, the sort of first thing that happened was I was really interested in this idea of what was happening with video online. And that was sort of like just starting to happen. And I just felt that, you know, there were so many examples of people taking formats from television and just tossing them online. And it felt a little off, you know, it felt a little like, you know, there was sort of an opportunity in this space that was kind of being ignored. I didn't have an idea necessarily of how to solve it, but I was at this, I went to this conference in Lisbon, where a friend of mine, Gary Carter, who's, I think, the
catcher for the Expos. Oh, wait, no,
different. No, he's like the chief creative officer, I think, for Fremantle Media, which is a, you know, big producer and buyer of content for television. And, you know, while I was there, I started talking about, like, well, what would it be like to have a formatless show? You know, a show that didn't have any format, but the format ended up being determined by audience interaction. And I couldn't point to really any examples of that having been done. So when I got back, I was to the States. I was like, "All right, let's try it." So I just kind of turned the camera on, and the idea was like, "Let's let it roll." But going back to the question that you asked, like, you know, what can you do? You know, you're stuck with this really, really difficult scenario of having lots and lots of voices come in. And then, you know, how are you going to try to respond to it, or how do you sort of like narrow it down? And I think that the answer to that is you just don't. You don't try. You know, the back and forth flow is like you're just going to have to hope that you come across something that's that, you know, inspires you. And then you have to try to give a lot of opportunities for all, you know, the people that are interested in doing stuff to do things, you know, outside of the context of the show.
I think it's a real art to involving an audience in a project that's yours, especially something as personal as what you were doing, because you don't, it's not a democracy. You're not saying like, all right, we're going to put everything up to a vote, and then that's what we'll, what I'll talk about. It's a collaboration, but it's a collaboration with people you don't know, and it's a collaboration with a large number of people, some of whom are antagonistic, some of whom are a little bit crazy, but some of whom are incredibly intelligent and can give you amazing things that you could never do without them. How do you approach that? How do you decide, like, who to trust, who to involve, how to involve them? That's something that I feel like I'm always dealing with in the different shows that I do, which is, you know, what's that feel? Because you can, when you're collaborating with other hosts, they'll say, like, I'll say, like, well, the audience doesn't really like that. And then it, if they disagree, it becomes an argument of like, well, I can show you parts of the audience that do like that, or we shouldn't listen to them because they're just complainers. Like, how do you navigate that?
That's such a difficult question to answer. I mean, you know, the first thing is that it's a mistake to just to although you can say the audience and things like that, I think it's a big mistake to conceive of it as the audience, because that just, it's a nonsensical term. You know, when it comes down to it, it's the problem of demographics. Like, if you start creating things with these kind of like imaginary subsets of persondom in mind, I think you become very, very quickly lost, or at least you lose any sort of chance of any kind of like deeper connection with people. You can definitely target things like humor and get across certain kinds of content. But if you start, like, you know, forgetting that behind each screen is a face, and behind that is a mind that's so deeply complex and crazy that it'd be impossible to try to like design for it. Anyway, demographics are really useful for like research and like for coming up with new ideas. But when you're actually starting to collaborate with people, I think that it's, you know, I don't know. I tend to like try to trust everyone at first, and then, you know, see where the interactions lead. But I think you're going to have to be a little more specific with the question.
Sure. No, I'm being broad on purpose because I'm not asking for a particular answer. But it is this situation where I read an email from somebody and they're like, I hate what you just did. And what I try to do is look at that and say, you know what? There's something that they're reacting to. Even if I disagree with them that what I did was awful, maybe the way I did it particularly set them off. And it's not what I did that set them off, but how they did it. And you sort of answered my question when you said you've got to remember that behind every screen is an actual human being. And they're not, people aren't, even trolls aren't inherently evil. They're not inhuman. And the idea of saying, look, I'm going to trust people until I have a reason not to trust them is good. But the other side of the question is, how do you decide who to involve if you don't have a way to involve everyone?
That's interesting. I think we should go back to the first thing you said, which is, I think, a really, really interesting problem. And that is, you know, the problem of the impact and intent of a critic. Because that's certainly something that, you know, I've struggled with in the past and continue to struggle with. And I think a lot of content creators, you know, have that problem when they start making public media. And isn't it a strange dance that we do? You know, I mean, like you said, you know, there's this stuff that comes at you and like you're sort of like, oh, like, you know, what did I do? How can I conceive of this person who's like so pissed off at me for, you know, and you don't really understand where all that stuff is going. And like you said, you know, they could be having a bad day, all that. I'm not so generous to say that no one is evil. I do think that there are really bad people out there. I think a majority of the people that are, you know, pretty vicious are not bad people. But it points to a really interesting thing because, like, you know, you put stuff out there and then it gets taken in a lot of different ways, and both negative and positive. You know, I'm sure you've also experienced the opposite, where people read in to what you're saying or doing in an incredibly, you know, deep and profound way that you didn't really intend. And that can be
not
just
so
as
much in my case, but I know what you're talking about.
I don't believe that.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I working in video, the mechanics of your productions are really fascinating to me. And you mentioned earlier in the show that you started to just write, to memorize a line at a time of your what could be called monologue of sorts into the camera, so that I assume you weren't using a teleprompter and you didn't have to memorize too much at once. And there was kind of a fun jump cutty type of a style to it that, for me, I remember watching those videos 6-7 years ago and going, wow, that's really a good use of not having to have one long take, because it's all intentional, but in a way you're getting around a more difficult process. I love that. And you see this online all the time now. I mean, it is a style. It's an internet
Ask
style.
Ask a Ninja was another one.
I mean, that must be kind of crazy to have spawned a whole kind of media, I don't know, it's like the online way to do things, which is very much not that old TV model that you were saying doesn't necessarily work well online.
I mean, there is something, you know, crazy about it, and there's also something really, like, awesome about it, and it's also been really, really neat to see, you know, a number of different content creators take not only the sort of like stylistic aspects of the show further, but also some of the other elements. Like, I think the Vlogbrothers have done a really, really great job of taking some of the sort of like ideas and mechanics of like the community and the sort of like fun play space of community and pushing that a lot further with an amazing, big, deep, rich community. And there's, you know, other folks that kind of like took the language in some directions, and And yeah, but you know, one thing that you said, which was totally, totally right on, was it was complete. The style was totally followed the necessity. Like there was no way that I was going to memorize the lines.
Form was determined by function, huh?
Yeah, totally. And the reason that my eyes were like, you know, open all the time is because I was concentrating so hard on hitting the take that I, you know, like I forgot to blink basically. And
do you find that you now have to force your eyes to be open because you know that's what people expect?
No, I mean, I think I'm still, I actually like, I have a little bit of a frenetic, like, you know, personality, especially when I get excited about things, it's not that hard for me to do. But that was sort of the fun of it was like, people were like, you don't blink. And I was like, all right, so it's an open format. You're just telling me that this show is a show that I don't blink in. So like, here we go. We're going to do that. And in the same way, the jump cuts started as just a way of like, I made a commitment to use just like consumer technology when I made the show. I wanted to use stuff that everybody had access to. In the beginning, it was like, you know, it was just a way of getting around memorizing. But then that became a style too. And I started cutting it tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. I started cutting off the letter S, which I'm just trying to take all the space out between cuts. And that led to faster and faster delivery, which, led to this kind of like weird frenetic jumble, which is it's fun. It's also annoying in equal measure.
It lends itself well to the short style, though. I mean, a 3 to 5 minute video, that makes it exciting. A lot of stuff happens in those 3 to 5 minutes, whereas if it was something read to a camera, it would drag. And that's just, I mean, it's just a good way to go about getting a message across when it's that fun internet, nobody has that much time to sit there and watch video type of style that we're all used to now.
Yeah, you're probably right. It's driven a little bit by the pure attention span of the medium. But I also think that it's because it's very easy to replay and revisit, unlike television, which is, you know, it's a little bit of a hassle. You have to record it. It's not easy to scan back and forth or longer. You have the opportunity to do things faster than the mind can process and allow people to kind of go back and reconstruct things. And I think that, you know, the sort of mixed media element of online includes, kind of mixing concepts and, you know, pushing in a lot of different directions at once. And I think that kind of like, you know, frenetic energy and confused and kind of like crazy dialogue is really, maybe it's like a way to pray to the internet.
Yeah, I think people are surprised that you don't talk like that all the time, because that's the impression when they watch the videos. They think that the editing is you.
He's this really neurotic guy, and we're just watching.
They're expecting your
life.
Head to jump all over the place right now. It's just this style they've come to expect.
Yeah.
So after a year of 5-day-a-week videos, which I wouldn't believe anybody who didn't say who didn't say it was a grind. You ended The Daily Show on March 17th, 2007. Mm-hmm. And what were you just tired? Did you need a break? Did you have something better to do? What was your job situation?
I have not had any kind of like normal job since 1999. During the kind of like lean years before the show started, where I was just trying to like, you know, figure out online content, I was like doing banner ads and all kinds of like, you know, crappy work like that. The show ended. It's actually within the first week of the show, I said that it was only going to be a year long. And that was in the beginning, that was more a flight of fancy or this concept. You know, I felt like nothing ever ended online. It was, you know, it was just kind of like things went on perpetually and then eventually became a 404 because they became, you know, lost or underviewed. So I wanted to play with time, and I wanted also to see I was a camp counselor, and I was a climbing instructor and things like that back in the day. And there was one camp that I worked at where we would go on these longer trips, 5 weeks trips, and they were, you know, there was like sort of this weird kind of like culty soft skills aspect to it. Not too weird, but the idea was that we were supposed to lead them in these group exercises where they would have to talk out things. And the idea was that, you know, there's sort of different psychological phases that you go through as a group in a 5 week trip. And there's like the honeymoon period, and then there's the period of tension, and then resolution, and then there's this like fond farewell goodbye thing. And really what they're talking about is kind of like, you know, a narrative arc in a way to an experience. And so I was interested in that. I was interested in, you know, what that would look like. And this is all sort of like theoretical. By like the middle of the show, I was like, you know, the idea that I was going to end at some point was like one of the only things that kept me going. Because, you know, I was tired all the time, and like my mind had been completely given over to the world of the show. And, you know, I'm going through that process a little bit right now with Usha. I'm tired as hell. You know, I'm like really tired right now. And I lost my duck stamp this morning. And, you know, I was afraid that I was going to be really cranky for this show because of it.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I appreciate it. By the end of it, there was definitely like moments where I was like, oh man, I should sort of like think about not ending, or like, you know, going dark and then reopening. But you know, at that point, the most exciting parts of the show were also the least amenable to something that would be sustainable, you know, that could turn into a business or a way of life. You know, the show had become like this like crazy series of like inside references and jokes. It was almost unshareable, because if there was a moment inside of one of the videos that was shareable, it was followed by something like a chess move that I was playing with my audience or something like that. And, you know, you couldn't embed them anywhere because they just wouldn't make sense anywhere. So, you know, in order to kind of, you know, and in addition to that, like the ad models for video were still pretty naive at that point, and it wasn't totally clear, you know, how the model would work and everything. But anyways, the parts that I loved the most were the least sustainable. And so I figured, you know, it's probably just stick to the original commitment and shut it down.
Well, I want to talk to you about why you decided to launch a show and put yourself through all that again in a minute. But we need to take a break and thank our sponsor for the show, Pond5. The world's stock media marketplace. If you are a content creator, and I know many folks out there are, they want to make their own shows, or you are making your own shows, or your blog, website, or films. Pond5 is one of the best ways to add some high-quality creative resources. If you're looking for some stock footage of Beijing or pandas or lemurs, they've got all of that and more. Check it out. They've got photos, vector illustrations, music tracks, sound effects, motion graphics, templates, and other creative assets. I challenge you to create a film about pandas and lemurs and their adventures in Beijing, and you can do it all with stock photos from Pond5. Download it instantly for legal use in pretty much any media production you can think of. Establishing shots, sound effects, anything you want. Pond5 is also a dynamic marketplace if you're an artist. You can upload pro-quality content, set your own prices, and receive industry-leading royalties on every sale. Which means that media makers, the prices are unbeatable, and so is the range and quality of content available. If you're a media maker working with video or images or sound, why not go check it out right now? Pond5, P-O-N-D, and the number 5.com. And there's a special offer for audience members here at TWIT, 25% off your purchase this month when you use the coupon code TWIT25. That's Pond5.com, TWIT25. Check it out now. We thank Pond5 for their support of Triangulation. Back to Zay Frank. So 5 years later, after you relieved yourself of the show, you now got a show starting a few weeks ago with Invocation for Beginnings, which I was really excited about. We showed it on a show that I do here called Frame Rate about web video. And my co-host, who had never seen the show, was like, I don't quite get it. And I was like,
I need context.
Okay, you will get it. Keep watching or go back and watch the show. And then I actually sent him a recent episode, the one, The Nows. And that was the one that he's like, okay, that clicks. Now I get it.
Right. Well, that's the easiest one to get, right? Yeah.
But so what brought you back around to wanting to do a show again? And do you have a deadline, an expiration date on this one as well?
Well, first of all, I want to say you're very good at doing that those promos. I was impressed by that.
That's very nice of you to say.
Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do. To come off as sincere as you did, and I'm now interested in pandas and lemurs.
Yes,
I'm hoping someone will take me up on that.
Yeah,
because
no,
I want to find out about their adventures in Beijing.
Yeah, the panda's not a stretch. The lemur maybe.
Well, the lemur's visiting. I'm guessing.
Is it? I gotcha. So I'll start. I mean, no, there's no expiration date.
Okay.
And this is a 3-day-a-week show, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, which is way more manageable. It's I'm still like kind of getting my my bearings on it a little bit. It's hopefully going to go on for quite a bit. We'll see how it develops. So, in terms of why now and things like that, I mean, it's sort of part of a bigger thing for me. I have a company called Zafrank Games, which is a venture backed company that I started 2.5 years ago, and really, you know, the idea there is I'm really interested in the mechanics of participation, and I think the overall value of real deep engagement with audiences. I mean, I see all these audiences out there, smaller audiences, 30,000, 50,000, 100,000, even smaller than that, 15,000 of people who are really, really excited about a show, about a personality, about a topic, you name it. And there's a lot of both technology and also philosophy that can facilitate some real awesome experiences for those fans. And that can be anything as simple as like some of the great technologies that already exist out there, like reviews and ask and answer and things like that. But what I wanted to do was focus on a lot of the other aspects like play and the creation of things and stuff like that. So Starmy is a site that I created out of that. And Starmy is a platform. And it's a platform that is actually driving a show. It's really about trying to, have an easy and powerful way of having, great participation-based projects and community. After having launched Starmy and, having kind of like gone around and worked with a number of different folks in implementing the platform on their sites to power stuff, the main thing that I ended up with was like, I kind of want to do this and sort of show people what I mean by, this technology.
Like, so you built Starmy, you wanted to use it yourself, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I kind of want to, I mean, you know, I think that there's like this amazing sort of like secondary landscape for, I'm going to sort of like switch it over to the business side for a second. But I just think that there's, I look at the advertising companies and I look at how they're, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on these micro sites and these little campaigns. And they're always sort of like saying like, well, we want to do these projects where we get like fans to contribute things. And it just feels like every time we're starting from scratch. And, from my perspective, like if the brands really want to like start experiencing audiences and really facilitating collaboration and things like that, they should go to audiences that already exist. and help with projects that actually mean something to those audiences. And that's what, you know, this technology does. And, you know, so any brands out there listening, you know, come and sponsor a wild, weird project at the show. And we'll be happy to, you know, I guess, help foster, you know, some real like fun and deep engagement. So that's sort of like, you know, at that point I was like, all right, so I kind of want to do this, but the show is, you know, different than the software company, and sort of like, you know, need to be funded kind of independently because it's not, you know, a piece of that that business powered by it, but a piece. And so, you know, I was sort of like, well, I think if I want to do this, I got to sort of test the waters a little bit and see whether people are excited to have it. So I went to Kickstarter you know, just wanted to raise like enough capital to like get it going, get the production going and the expensive cameras. Everything's more expensive now. I thought it was supposed to be cheaper.
The more you want to do with it, the more expensive it gets. It's really cheap if you're us in the 90s again, starting out right now. It's like, oh my gosh, I can get like a tablet that has a camera built in and do iPhoto and iMovie, and you know, it's only $500, and that's amazing. Like that would blow my mind. 13-year-old me would just be like, you know, salivating. But when you get you all of a sudden you're like, no, now I want to do a little more. I want to have more complex camera shots, and I want a good camera. I know what a good camera is now, and I know the difference. You're going through this with speakers right now.
So. Oh gosh, my speaker saga, it's a never-ending one. Zay, you mentioned that you just wanted to, when you first started experimenting with video, and definitely daily video, you just wanted to use consumer products. You didn't want to do anything too fancy. That was sort of the point. And I think that that's what's interesting now is the consumer products are really good and intricate.
Right, it's a fuzzy line.
Yeah, and in some cases kind of expensive because people are just used to it. Like, well, everybody uses Final Cut, so you got to get Final Cut, that sort of thing. You know, and everybody's got a 5D Mark II because it's the best for video. So has your process changed, even though we showed a little clip of it a few minutes ago of the way that the new version of the show looks, and it does look... I mean, the shot
orange.
It looks orange by choice. I watched that. You wanted to just take it to Oompa Loompa.
I was going to say naranja, but yeah.
But, I mean, is your process different at all, or are you approaching this just as you did the first time around with obviously a little bit more experience under your belt?
I mean, it's just, you know, there's no way of going back to, you know, 640, 480 on a tape, you know, that you have to import to your iMovie and stuff like that. It's such a different process now. I mean, HD is, you know, it's just a different ballgame. You know, for the show, I had, I really wanted it to look in a particular way. And I was really interested in like the size of it on the screen. Mobile wasn't that big at that point, you know? And so like, I knew how the thing was going to be consumed, by the majority of people. So I actually encoded it at a very specific aspect ratio, non-standard, exported it at 15 frames a second with a little bit more compression than was needed to get this kind of like grungy, weird sort of effect on the videos. You know, in this case, like, I'm just trying to get the biggest, best looking file out there, because I have no idea how it's going to be consumed. The aspect ratio is so formatted now, so 16:9 is a totally different framing for me. I'm not used to it. It doesn't work as well for close-up shots, you know. I mean, it's just like, it's kind of like absolutely frightening.
Get yourself a bookcase and colorful.
that is a magic cubby. Don't call it a bookcase. So the process has totally changed, and I'm open to using, like you said, I think I'm just sort of like following your lead there, which is just like, you know, it's impossible to tell what's prosumer and what's not. I mean, you know, kids are using After Effects. These are all like basic skills now in the video world. So, you know, I'm definitely, I just feel like I'm just like, much more open to using lots of different kinds of stuff. And I just want to kind of improvise and play in the space and see what happens.
I like the way you're including people to help give examples of some of the play that you want people to engage in. You sort of unintentionally made a dream of mine come true when you took Veronica Belmont's Bear Dream, which was also her National Novel Writing Month novel premise, and made it come to life on screen.
Oh, yeah, I didn't make it come to
life.
Well,
I mean, you facilitated it. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. I love that series. There's actually going to be one in today's show. An animator, Lee Hall from Lost Marble Media, is animating people's dreams. And absolutely. I think it's just fantastic. And there's a number of other folks that are gonna come on. And I was super super excited this time around to get folks that are really really good at their respective crafts to come in and kind of like give something back to the audience and for the audience to kind of get a chance to collaborate. Basically, with some of these super talented people. So Lee Hall is one of them. Another one is Stefan Bucher, an illustrator who is solving problems.
I like that. Putting all of your fingers on all of these trees, was it? I can't remember now.
No, birds.
That's right.
Somebody had said that they were having trouble sitting still when they quit smoking, so he created a desktop, like a screensaver, a desktop. In the background where you had, it was a game where you had to touch 10 birds simultaneously. And then there was an 11th bird for your tongue, just in case.
Occupies the mouth. That's smart.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but then, in addition to that, there's some really fun surprises coming up soon. There's, a number of other people that are going to be doing this as well in, I think pretty surprising disciplines. I don't want to give too much away.
Cosmology? But,
yeah, exactly. We've got a dishwasher who's, that actually wouldn't be so bad.
I made the mistake of going to Starmie when you were talking about it earlier, and now I'm distracted making pumpkins and inspirational photo posters.
Yeah, Starmie, so you're on the Mission of the Day page, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go to the front of Starmie and go to the Mission of the Day, there's hundreds of little missions that you can go on. And the show is also doing missions. The lovely thing about the Starmie mission page is that there's also a section called the Community Mission page. So that's, if you sign up to the platform, you can start making your own missions, whether they're drawing missions or text missions or all sorts of different kinds of tools where you can try to test out your skill, see if you're good at making a rule set or a project that a lot of other people are going to participate in. One of my favorites, and I think I'm going to actually include it in the show today, was somebody was just like, "All right, the project is face typing. Just type with your face and then hit enter with your nose." And it was awesome. I mean, it was like one of the most participated in missions.
I would be tempted to type with the nose.
Huh? Would you?
Yeah. Well, I have a really long nose, so it just makes it easy.
No, it's more like you basically just slam your face.
Right.
And press enter.
Hope
and then
for
whatever.
Something coherent. Yeah. When you're talking about your process, you're saying, well, my video that I'll do later today, so because it's Friday, so it's one of those things that you can put together, and obviously you're an expert by now. You've also got Zayfrank Games, something like Starmie, where you've got daily challenges, and I think a lot of people will look at something that your body of work online and say, well, he's just like a genius, and when you're creative enough, you can make these sorts of things happen. But in reality, obviously, it's a lot of work. How do you manage everything that you're doing? Because I know 5 years ago, in some change, you were wondering how you're going to make the next video. It seems like you're doing more than ever.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, Zayfrank Games has the help of three amazing people who are sitting on either side of me, Sarah, Mike, and Sean. So the stuff like on Starmie, which is a really pretty deep and complex platform I could never have done myself. I mean, it's just completely impossible. So I don't know. I mean, yes, I'm you know, probably doing more now than I've ever done, but it definitely gets easier over time just because, you know, I'm spending a lot less of my time learning. You know, I can kind of like approach a lot of different pieces of software and technology and just kind of like dive in and play. And but you're right. I mean, the biggest thing is the work, not the creativity. I think that there is like work overall in developing some kind of relationship with your creativity, if you choose to think of it like that, which I do. You know, there's a process that you go through where you have to sort of like figure out, you know, how am I going to deal with the fact that I don't know when ideas are going to come, and I do know maybe how to feed, you know, feed that part of myself with like new information and you know, interesting experiences and conversations. But the idea is, you know, you never know. But the one thing that you do totally have under your control is the amount of work that you do. I personally, you know, try to just work. I love it. I love working. Do you like working?
When you're doing something that you like, then yes, I love working because I'm doing things that I enjoy. I mean, I get.
I always tell people that if I wasn't sitting here right now, I would be watching this interview because it's very interesting to me, and I like reading about technology and playing around with social networks. And Star Me was something that I logged into because I heard about it and it sounded cool. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a great job.
And it's, you know, what you say about getting good at something, once you get good at something, I think that's something companies, like, devalue all the time. They, like, move people around off projects and cancel projects and stuff, and they never let their employees actually get good at things. When you get good at things, you can start doing all kinds of crazy stuff and see what sticks and see what you like to do. I mean, I do a show that's just ridiculous, and it's not for making money. It's about fantasy sports and fantasy worlds, like J.R.R. Tolkien, all mashed up into one. And I just do it because I'm like, that sounds fun, and I know how to do podcasts at the drop of a hat, so I don't have to work hard at putting together a podcast.
You're shooting the breeze with a buddy for an hour,
exactly.
And then you make it a podcast, and other people get to enjoy it. How great is that?
Yeah, I think I really think that what you're saying is dead on, and I think that you know, it's an easy sort of mistake to make when, you know, especially, you know, if you spend your kind of like early 20s working really hard and constantly feeling like you're behind, you're sort of like behind, you know, like you're trying to like achieve something and you're not that good at the stuff and you're learning all the time and it's this struggle. And then all of a sudden, like you're starting to get like kind of good at it and it doesn't have that feeling to it anymore. You know, and at that point, you know, a lot of people get anxious and they're like, I gotta get that feeling again, or else I'm not moving. I'm not like progressing. And so they, you know, move off to something else. I certainly fell into that trap. But on the other hand, another way to look at it is to say, oh, wow, I can actually do this now. Let's, you know, focus on some of the other sort of like aspects of the craft, and round it out. But yeah, I think, and especially, you know, with employees in a company, I mean, the best situation that you can possibly get in is when, you know, your employees are doing things that they're good at, and because that makes you feel good. It's not awesome to, you know, constantly be struggling and learning and, you know, feeling like you're kind of like, only hitting at 70 to 80%.
Did you read the Valve employee manual that was circulating online recently?
No.
There was this long leak of the, apparently, what's the employee manual at Valve. It's a video game company, if people are familiar with it. But one of the things it said was, if you want to work on a project, work on the project. We don't assign you to things. The way projects get done at Valve is enough people decide it's worth working on, and so it happens.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sarah and I both were like, really, we know nothing about game design or programming, but we both want to work there.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're good at something. We'll figure it out.
I really like that. Yeah, that's a really wonderful a really wonderful way to work. I mean, I'm sure that there's quite a bit of management that has to go into a company like that. But that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's a cool idea anyway. Well, we're about near the end here, Sarah. Any last thoughts before we wrap up?
I mean, I guess I know you've gotten this question a million times, but I guess my question would be, we're talking a lot about do what you love. It's awesome. You just kind of have to find that thing. And yeah, it'll be hard work. But if you have that thing that you love, you'll like it and you won't mind working all the time. And I know that for some people, that's really hard to hear because that's just not how they feel that their life and their career is set up.
Or they feel the thing they love is nothing that they could ever have a job doing.
Exactly, because it just, they don't know how to get there. And I guess I would ask what your advice would be to somebody who wants to have more fun in career and life and doesn't feel that that's attainable.
Oh, that's a really difficult. I almost wish we'd started there.
In a couple words, could you answer
that? Yeah, we've got 30 seconds. Right. So, no.
I think that it's I think it's such a shame that we're a lot of us are driven by what I consider to be myths. One is the idea that if you just sort of like buckle down and work hard, eventually you'll get recognized. I think that's crazy. Another one would be that, things become popular because they're better. Mm. That's tough. And then the other one is that the ideal situation is that you should somehow find a circumstance in your life that you're just sort of like naturally happy to be in all the time. That's crazy. I just, this idea of this perfect job where you're just excited and happy all the time. I said that I love work. Love is a complicated emotion and only includes happiness a little bit of the time.
It includes a lot of fighting.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I really do think that, part of the challenge is not so much the thing that you're doing. I think that it's, you kind of like have to attack it at all angles. Obviously, the circumstance, your geography, the actual mode of your profession, they're big components. But there's also, the kind of like way that you approach them. Are you, capable of finding details in the work that you do that you can sort of explore deeper and fascinate yourself with? I think that I don't think that there is really any advice that I can give, because my career has been so weird and I have been much more of an opportunist than I have been someone that has started out with a goal and driven towards it. I'm very fortunate in a lot of ways for the opportunities that have presented themselves to me. And I don't know if it is a comfort to anyone. I struggle so much with being satisfied with the work that I do, and I struggle so much like wondering if I've made a giant mistake in my life and should have been doing something else. But I do deeply love the work. I don't think that those things are incompatible.
Do you think that, we've heard this from a lot of people on Triangulation, that the key is to take advantage of those opportunities that maybe you think are too risky, but you really want to take advantage of?
Yeah, I think that it's, I don't know how to say it. It's sort of like, there's this idea that keeps on popping up over and over again, and it has to do with this kind of like secondary awareness. Like I know it from the, in public speaking and in acting, you hear about this quite a bit, which is this idea that, while you're speaking and delivering lines, you have this second layer of awareness where you're kind of like scanning and you're looking at the environment around you and you're seeing what there is to react to. Public speaking is super important because like if you're in the middle of delivering a line and you see somebody falling asleep in the front row and you only are concentrating on your line, you're going to flub. You have to be able to process stuff and continue. So that kind of like split awareness, I think, is super important as a metaphor for a lot of things. And I think that, you know, when you're doing your career and you're sort of like super focused on stuff, it's always good to have that second eye on your surroundings and just sort of like processing, are there other opportunities here? How could I, you know, oh, that's an opportunity to learn something more just in a little slight way about something that I'm interested in. And yeah, and that's certainly the approach, you know, that helps me, is like constantly sort of scanning around for other kinds of opportunities. In terms of risk, I don't know. It's so weird. It's so hard to give people advice on how much risk to take.
Especially with Sarbanes-Oxley.
There you go.
yeah, it's a personal.
That was an awkward moment.
Yeah.
Well, it was like the lag, and I was sort of like watching you to try to figure out what was happening.
I was like, I hear him laughing, but I don't see him.
The secondary awareness was failing.
I think he's going to show up. Laughing.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we can blame technology.
That's right.
Well, that wraps us up. We got to get going. But Zay Frank, a pleasure to chat with you for this hour. Thanks so much for taking the time and talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And certainly. Come over to a show.zayfrank.com and participate in a show.
And you can find Triangulation right here on the Twit Network every week, usually on Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and always on demand at twit.tv/TRI. We'll see you next time.